a kid, there used to be a show called Romper Room, and it was for very young children. This was back in the 60s, when I was a child. And part of it was the lady who presented it would hold up what looked like a mirror. So she was like looking into a mirror. And she would say some magic word, and then they do a kind of a dissolve thing where the center of the mirror would disappear. So it's like you could see through the mirror and you could see her face. And she would say, "I can see you in your living room now." And she'd start saying names like, "I can see you, Brian, and I can see you, Peter, and I can see you, Paul." And my God, it was the most electric thing as a child, because I thought she could actually see me. And she'd say things like, "I can see you hiding behind the couch, Brian." Mind blowing. And I've never forgot that kind of feeling of like, you know, being seen. And people, only somebody sent me an email today saying they were listening to the podcast and they had sent in a question. I think it was for Colleen Berry. And, you know, when they heard their name being called out, they got a fright. I heard somebody else told me that they were doing some work for a government agency. So they were in this very high security facility, and part of, you know, during their downtime, they could make use of the gym. So they're on the treadmill and listening to the podcast, and same again, they'd sent in a question and I said their name and they nearly fell off the treadmill. They got such a fright. They were kind of looking over their shoulder. I suppose the underlying anxiety of being in a high security facility got the better of them. So when they heard their name being called. Anyway, the point of all that is, hello and welcome to another in-between-isode. And how are you? Now, if you're on your own, feel free to answer, because in some way, I'll get it. There'll be a communication and I'll hear you. In sort of, in a, you know, energetic kind of way. So how are you? And I'm not going to say, well, I'm glad to hear that, because you could have told me something very hard. But if you didn't, and it's going well, I'm glad to hear it. And if it's not going well, I'm still receiving it in some way or another. So another catch-up episode. A few things I just want to... The main thing I wanted to tell you was about, let me backtrack a little bit. The normal podcasts take a long time to do. Anyone who is waiting for the Colleen Berry episode will know what I mean. Took ages to actually get it together to record it, and then we had technical difficulties and it was delayed, and then editing it took forever as well. So because everybody's self-isolating, and there's a lot of people have emailed me saying, please, more podcasts. We need more content, more things to listen to. So I get that. So here's my idea. What I'm going to do is I'm going to do a series of uncut, unedited podcasts with artists who have already been on the podcast. So I'll be inviting them back. Reason for that is, if I was going to do it with a new artist, I want to, you know, I don't want to skimp on it. I want to do the research. I want to edit it because those interviews are like little time capsules, and they are in a way historical documents. I mean, who is it? Laura Atkins always kind of jokingly calls me Vasari, and well, that's very flattering. But there is, you know, who knows where these will end up. So I want them to be as good as they can be. So what my idea is with these uncut ones is artists who've already been on. And then all the questions will be generated by you, the listeners. So I've put a post on my Instagram, and I have an alphabetical list of all the artists who've been on the podcast. And I'm asking everybody to go and give me their top 10 in preference. And the idea is I'll record. I'll obviously get in touch with the artist, and all going well, they'll be available and willing. But, you know, everybody who's been on the podcast, I have a reasonably good relationship with, and I'm pretty sure they'll be happy to do it because everybody's isolating as well. So the idea is I'll record, and within a day or two, I'll be able to get it out. But it will be unedited. So you'll just have to put up with all the oohs and ahs and ums and all the stuff that I spend so much time getting rid of, and maybe you'll hear what the difference is, and maybe, you know, you'll say, hey, Morty, I don't know what you're doing all that for. They're fine. But to my ear, they're not. Anyway, the point is, you'll get the unedited version, so you'll get the content, you'll get a chance to ask your questions as well, because it's kind of in two phases. There'll be the who do you want me to get back on the podcast, and then I'll announce, okay, this is who it's going to be, and then you get to send in your question, and yeah, you'll get to fall off your treadmill when your name is called out. So yeah, I'm not going to be doing any extra research or anything like that. The whole idea is to help the process be as quick as possible, so that you get a bit of content, that you get a podcast, and I don't know how many I'm going to be able to churn out, but that's what I'm going to try and do. That's the idea. So the call to action, if you like, is to go and look at my Instagram feed. It's the Salvador Dali. There's a big picture of Salvador Dali. That's the post. Go to that post and then put in who you want come on the podcast. And then I'll just keep churning through them until this whole thing is over. I had like the next podcast that I would have normally done would have been in between a episode. I had a couple of things lined up for that. I might just break those up into shorter little podcasts rather than, because there's a huge amount of work in the in between episodes. And again, by the time it's all done and out, this will all be over. So yeah, that's kind of what that's that. So yeah, go and look at the Instagram feed, Salvador Dali post. Can't miss it. Let me know who you'd like. I mean, you can email me if you want, or contact me in some other way. But it just, again, slows everything down, because I have to try and gather all the, you know, votes, if you like, from all different sources. It's better if it's just in the Instagram. I can do it easier there. So I had a lovely email from somebody, just sort of saying that really, I've had lots of great feedback from everybody about these kind of catch-ups. Everybody's enjoying them, so that's great. Do keep sending me the feedback, because as I said before, I'm very conscious of feedback. I listen to it, and if it stops, I'll kind of get the sense of that as being an indication of, okay, maybe it's time to stop doing these. So this person sent me this email, and they were talking about a few different things, but one kind of thing that stood out in it is they were saying that, and very honestly saying that, listening to art podcasts is kind of hard for them because they have a day job, and they are just envious of listening to artists who are working full time in art and don't have to have a day job. And I totally get that, because a lot of my life has been observing other people having more success in fields that I've been involved in. So like, it goes back to, well, like probably the biggest and earliest was, like, I was in a band from the age of about, I don't know, 15 until about 21. So it was about 7 years. And myself and my friend, John Morrissey, we used to practice 3 or 4 times a week, and we wrote songs, and we had big dreams. We were, you know, very interested in music, being very successful in music. But, you know, we had another agenda to it as well, that we in inverted commas wanted to change the world for the better. And so we had a kind of, you know, we felt like there was it was very important what we were trying to do, and we really gave it everything. And we got quite close. And what's interesting is that we were doing that roughly around the same time that you two were breaking through. They might have been slightly ahead of us by 6 months to a year, but it wouldn't have been much more than that. And this would have been very early 80s. We nearly got a record deal. We got very close. We went into the studio. We saved up our money and we went into the studio and we recorded our songs and sent off our demo tapes to the record companies. And we had very favorable responses. And I think we had a meeting with an A&R guy. Got really close to getting a deal, which was the golden ticket that everybody who was in a band was looking for, because that's the way it worked back then. There was no YouTube, no independent music scene really at all. It was a record company or nothing. And we were hoping we'd be discovered. And we did a couple of gigs as well. We didn't do a huge amount of gigs, but we did a few. Enough to know that we knew that if we kept doing them, we'd get better and better and better at them. And we got some reasonable reviews in the Irish music press. Nothing huge, but it was the beginnings. You could tell where it was going. And the next step would have been for us to go to London, and we didn't for a few different reasons. So it's been interesting for me to kind of watch the trajectory of U2, and in a way it's kind of like I sort of feel like, say, Bono out of U2, that he's kind of lived the life that I might have lived, and that in a reverse kind of way I'm perhaps living the life that he might have lived. And that's happened to me a few times with different people. Like after I did that, I did a couple of other things, but then I got involved in the film industry, and for quite a while I thought I was very interested in doing directing films. And similarly, it sort of very nearly happened, but didn't. When I was, you know, in my 20s, I'd referenced to Orson Welles, who directed Citizen Kane when he was 27, or maybe he was 25, or something ridiculously young. So, you know, I was comparing myself to him, and then that didn't happen. I was like, oh, well, it's a different world. And then, you know, I got to see people my age go into film directing and be film directors and very successful film directors. Some I sort of knew or had associations with, like young Neil Jordan. I worked in an animation studio, and he came in one day and he was looking at our cameras to do the credits of a film he was working on, or to do some of the special effects. And so I sort of knew him. And Dublin was a sort of place where, you know, if anybody was successful at all, you know, you'd throw a stone, you'd hit somebody who knew that person. So, you know, I was always kind of close to it. So my point is that it's easy to look at other people and get jealous, like this person was saying. It's a very understandable reaction. But what I've kind of come to, and I kind of touched on it a little bit when I was talking about open source Crani on the last catch up, is that, well, let me backtrack a little bit. How it kind of all kind of made sense to me was actually working in cranial cycle therapy and treating people who had life-threatening illnesses, like people who had cancer, or, you know, it was very serious. Because with most things that people would come and see me with, say somebody, you know, was out dancing the previous night and twisted their ankle, and they came and were like, oh, I've twisted my ankle, can you help? Those kind of things are very physical and kind of superficial. And they usually had to do with the person and their environment. I twisted my ankle, or I had an accident and fell down some stairs, and that's all there was to it. Then there are other people who would come and they'd have physical symptoms that had emotional roots. So they might have had some sort of childhood trauma that manifested years later as some sort of illness. Or they were deeply unhappy about something and that manifested as some kind of illness. So that the emotional stuff was often to do with the person and other people. My father did this to me, my mother did that to me, my wife is doing this to me, my husband is doing that to me, whatever. And so that's like 90% of the sort of people I would see. But then people with the terminal kind of, or not terminal, potentially terminal or life-threatening illnesses, that they're where the root causes of their thing was much deeper. And it made me have to kind of look as like, well, what's really going on here? And over years, it started to dawn on me that what seemed to be going on was that in this realm that's under the physical and under emotional, there's this process that seemed to be going on, and I could see it in everybody's life and in my own life in a way. And it has to do, I wrote about this in my book, which is about health, the Why Do We Get Sick, Why Do We Get Better book. And it's to do with what I kind of came to call our question. And just to sort of frame it in a kind of context. And really, it is just, I'm just framing it in a context, because you can look at things in any way you like, really. So you can look at them in one way and go, well, that's just a series of random events that have led to a particular thing. Or you can look at it another way and you can see a chain of synchronicity or meaning. And one is as valid as the other. I just find the meaning one is more empowering. So, for example, in the book, as a way of kind of prefacing it, I ask the reader a series of questions. I think we all can relate to this. So to get the idea across and to help it become more personal for the person reading the book, I ask them a series of questions. So I'll ask you, right, so you can have it more personal for you. And with this, when you're thinking about answering these questions, if you can discount anything that you've might believe or that you've been told, but just something that you've got direct knowledge of. So here's the questions, all right? Why were you born the gender you were born? Why were you born the race you were born? Why were you born in the country you were born? Why were you born to the parents you were born? So most people don't know the answer to those questions. Not really. I mean, when you bring in beliefs, yeah, you can have loads of answers or what you've been told. But if you discount those, you don't really know what the answer to those questions are. But nearly everybody feels that they're significant, that there's a significance to why you were born to the parents you were born. There's a significance to why you were born the gender you were born. There's a significance to the country you were born in. It's sort of a feeling, but you couldn't say why. And to kind of further help that point across, I use this analogy of a kid who likes to run and jump in the back garden. And they, all day long, they run and they jump and they have the best time. They love running and jumping. It's their favorite thing to do. They spend the whole summer doing it. And then one evening they come in and they're passing a window and they see the Olympics on the TV. And the hurdles race is about to start. And they're mesmerized by this, because this is like running and jumping heaven. And they have this question. They go, wow, that's amazing. I wonder if I could do that. I wonder if I could be good at that. And then, you know, fast forward 10 years, 15 years, and they are in the Olympics and they are on the starting blocks and the gun goes off and they run. And the question is still the same. I wonder how good I can be at this, because I love running and jumping, but I want to see how good I am in this situation. And what they've done is they have voluntarily adopted a lot of constraints. They have to run between the lines. All the jumps are the same height. They can't knock any of them over, I don't think. They can't start whenever they feel like it. They have to start when the gun goes, and so on and so forth. So it's the voluntary adoption of a lot of constraints. And it feels like you can apply that to life, like those questions I just asked. The why you were born, the gender you were born, parents, city, town, and all the different things that happened to you in your life. You can look at it from the perspective of, I chose all this for a reason, to answer a particular question, in the same way that that kid was answering the question about, I wonder how good I can be at this. Everybody, to me anyway, it looks like, has this question running through their lives that they're trying to answer. And all the circumstances that they've drawn to themselves are helping them to answer that question. And as I've talked to people about this, it's very understandable. They go, oh, what's my question? What's my question? I think I know what my question is. And it's a paradox, because it's not so much to figure out what your question is as to keep asking the question of yourself. what is my question? So you could drive yourself insane wondering what the question is that's running through your whole life that you're trying to figure out. I mean, I know from treating people that it's often to do with going back to that analogy or the differences between, say, physical is you and the environment and emotional is you and other people. This stuff is you and you. So it's usually something to, along the lines of, it's very broad, like, am I good? Am I powerful? How good am I? That kind of thing. It's not, very detailed, like, I wonder if I can jump over a house or something, specific or ridiculous. It's usually broad, but it's there, and certainly with people who are having life-threatening illnesses, they were very deeply into that question. It was like their whole life had been put on hold so that they could really look at a particular aspect of that. So that is a very long-winded way of getting around to back to the what I was saying about the person feeling jealous. So for me, anyway, having all these close encounters and parallel lives with people who were much more successful in fields that I was interested in. Like, I was just looking at Taiko Waititi. Yeah, I remembered his name, or pronounced his name properly, doing his Oscar acceptance speech. And he is, he's probably 20 years plus younger than me. And he's gone from, started off very small and now he's directing huge films. Something that I would have loved to have done when I was interested in that, directing films. And I don't have any jealousy towards him. I don't have any envy. I'm very happy for him. And I delight in the thoughts of, like, oh, it must be lovely for him. And God, I'd love to do that. It'd be great. I think I'd love to do that. It'd be great. But I kind of know that my life has gone in the way that it has because of this question, my question that I'm working out. And, don't email me asking me what it is, because I don't know what it is. But I continually wonder about it. Not, it doesn't keep me awake or anything like that. But every new event and thing that happens, I view it through the filter of that. And as I say, you can view your life of, like, it's a series of random events. It's all meaningless. And you could be right. I don't find that particularly empowering or fun. It's not fun. But viewing it from the other way, which is it is all meaningful, everything is significant, and it goes to a purpose. And the purpose is that I am trying to figure out something about my life, and this question, this very fundamental question that I have about myself, that I am working through. And, it could be confirmation bias. If you don't know what confirmation bias is, it is, it's like if you have a belief about something, then you will interpret the facts to match your belief, which is a very human thing to do. So I could be doing that. But as I look back on my life, it's very clearly to me, so far anyway, that everything has been around a central theme and a central question. So that's why it's easy for me to not have envy and to not go, oh, Bono, you have my life. I don't have that at all. I'm happy for Bono. At this stage, I kind of think I got the better deal. I don't know why I feel like that, but I just have a feeling I've had it easier, because when I was younger, like in my 20s, the idea of fame and being a rock star was very attractive. Now I'm very happy to be anonymous and to not be famous and not be recognized. So I'm glad I'm not Bono. I don't know if you relate to that. I think everyone can, just from talking to people and my observation of people, it is easy to kind of have a frustration when you see other people do things that you're trying to do and they're doing much better than you are. And, say in art, right? You look at their art and they're like, I'm as good as them. Why aren't I selling as well as they are? Why do I still have my day job? It's very understandable. But for me, anyway, I don't have that. Because, as I say, I have this sense of well, it's more than a sense. It's an observation of my life as it unfolds. And it's everything is tailor-made to help me unravel this. And I suppose I have the advantage of working with people in this very deep kind of way, if it happens to be in that deep way. I mean, if somebody just comes in and they twisted their ankle, great. That's, we don't, you know, it's not like, yeah, but what about your question? No, we don't, I don't do that. Everything comes from whatever has gone on for the person. But from seeing people who the root cause of their illness was rooted down in this stuff, and then they, it changed, and it's not like they suddenly knew what their question was and they answered it. I don't think that's the point. As I say, it's a paradox. You have to keep asking, but not get frustrated that you don't get an answer. And then they resolve this particular aspect of their question, and they, you know, made miraculous, in some cases, recoveries, or in other cases, they recovered slowly and not so miraculously looking, but still, like, from my perspective, I could feel the change in their, let's call it their system, meaning, you know, mind, body, spirit, whatever you want to call it, the whole package. I could feel that change, and then as something resolved down in this very deep area, and then they they got better. So I've got a lot of reference for this. Again, could be confirmation bias, but, you know, you can drive yourself nuts as well, second guessing yourself, going, you know, am I delusional or what's going on? And you can, you know, there's an argument to be made for everybody's delusional, and you just choose the delusion that you like and the one that makes you happy, and you go with that. But of course, I don't I don't feel like I'm delusional. It feels real to me. So if you have that kind of envy, if you listen to artists on the podcast and you're like, you have that bit of frustration, that bit of envy, I am sharing all that with you in the hope that maybe it'll make it a little bit easier for you in the way that it's easier for me. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, God, I'm really enjoying this podcast. I've listened to a few now and they're brilliant. And there's so many of them. And I've learned so much from listening to them. And you know what? If I met that John Dalton fella in real life, I'd love to buy him a cup of tea and have a chat with him. I'd love to do that every month if I could. Well, now you can. The tea part, at least, because this podcast runs on cups of tea bought for me by people like you who listen to the podcast and send me the price of a cup of tea once a month through the Patreon account. That's patreon.com/John Dalton, gently does it, all one word. And if you're one of those people who already send me cups of tea through Patreon, thanks a million. The tea is lovely and I really appreciate it. Now, the great thing is that if you can't afford to send me the price of a cup of tea, or you don't want to, that's fine. You still get exactly the same podcast for free. It's sort of an honor system where the people who can afford it and want to pay for the people who can't or don't want to. So it's all lovely. So if you'd like to send me a cup of tea once a month, you can do that through Patreon. I'd really appreciate it. It makes a huge difference to me. I shared a podcast that I did with Donny McLaughlin in 2015. So yeah, 5 years ago I had Donny on. Donny is a remarkable person, and he is the founder of the Post Growth Institute. And it's funny listening back to it. I mean, I found it very interesting back then, but now, with everything the way it is, because we've got two things going on at the moment. We've got the health side of the current situation, but then we're going to have an economic side to the current situation as well. And what Donnie's whole thing was that, and what the Post Growth Institute is about, is that having an economy that, where the system of the economy is that it has to keep growing and growing and growing and growing, is not sustainable on a finite planet, because the planet doesn't keep growing, which is kind of obvious when you think about it. So what he is trying to do is help the economy transition into an economy that doesn't rely on growth. And it's not it's not political, it's not like socialism or capitalism or a version of anything like that. It's just pretty much economics, but driven by compassion, really, because he's a very compassionate sort of fellow. Anyway, I'm recommending it to you to have a listen to. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's episode 21 if you're looking for it. It's one of the ones I managed to get onto YouTube. It's not like you're going to see any moving pictures or anything, but sometimes YouTube can be easier to listen to things on. So yeah, I recommend you listen to that again. It's just very interesting to hear Donnie talk and think about what the economy is going to look like when we're through this health part and the economy starts again. Because certainly my news feed, and I've seen it in a lot of different places, people are going, I don't want things to go back to the way they were. I want some parts of the way things were, but it would be great if we lost or dropped other parts, the not so great parts. So yeah, listening to Donnie talking about the post-growth and what's possible, he's very big on not-for-profit businesses, which I didn't know that much about until I talked with Donnie, and then I started to see the possibilities, and we'll probably see more not-for-profit surge forward after the health part of this is over, because that's what happened after 2008. The not-for-profit businesses weathered that way better than the for-profit businesses, and then they grew, and their other not-for-profits started. So not-for-profits are great because a lot of the drive for growth is driven by the drive for profit. And speaking of lovely companies, I think this is a for-profit company, but I'm not so sure. And if you're in America, I'm going to tell you about it because it's great, but you won't be able to get one. And this is a full-on promotion, except I'm not getting any money for this, but it's almost, it feels like an ad. It's for a company called Fairphone, and they're in Amsterdam, and they make a mobile phone. Okay, nothing too unusual about that. Well, I suppose a company in Amsterdam making a phone, is that unusual? Maybe. But I heard about them years ago when they were teeny tiny, because I got sick of my phone. Like, I got sick of the fact that it was just this all contained unit and that I couldn't do anything with, and I was stuck with it, and I was at the mercy of what's called planned obsolescence, which is a nice way of saying it's designed to fail after a couple of years so that you buy the next version of the phone, which seems so corrupt to me and used to really annoy me. But then also the fact of, like, you know, I like to take photographs, so sometimes the cameras are not great, and I kind of thought, wouldn't it be great if you could just swap out the camera and put in a better camera, you know? And like, when mobile phones started, you could change the battery, you could go and get a new battery, and then suddenly it was all like, oh no, you can't even do that. So I first came across Fairphone because I was interested in modular phones, and there was a few kind of floated, but what I immediately liked about Fairphone was that their phone is designed to last for about 5 years, and you can change the bits yourself, everything from the battery to the camera to the screen to everything. It's a slightly chunkier phone, not by much now, but a slightly chunkier phone, but everything has got little screws, and you can take the whole thing apart yourself. In fact, the back cover is see-through, and you can see all the components and the bits and bobs. And you know if you wanted to change the screen, if you scratched your screen or cracked it, God, the number of people that you meet and they've got a beautiful iPhone and the screen is like all cracked. And they're just, you know, well, I'm not going to change it. Like, I'm stuck. I've got this plan. I'm not ready for an upgrade yet, or I'm not eligible for an upgrade yet. It's insane. Whereas, yeah, you can just send away, like, on their website to Fairphone, get a new screen, get a new camera. If they make a better camera, they'll tell you, and you can just upgrade, and they'll send it out to you, two little screws, and you put it in. So anything goes wrong with the phone, you can, once it's in one of these modules, I got one, right? Finally, I waited until my iPhone 5 was dying and dying and dying. I changed the battery in it myself. I think if you look back on my Instagram feed, you can see that I did that. And it felt like brain surgery. And really, you know, it was almost like the Apple police were going to kick the door down and go, what are you doing? Yeah. It felt like that, you know. But anyway, I changed it, and the battery in my iPhone, I got another year or two out of it. But then eventually, yeah, it died. So just before Christmas, I got a Fairphone, the latest one, the Fairphone 3, because I didn't want to say anything about it until I'd actually got one. And I got one for Maggie as well, my wife. And she had Android before. I was iPhone, and you know, I was like, oh God, what's going to be like switching to an Android phone? And it's brilliant. It's fine. Now, maybe going from an iPhone 5 to this phone, it seems like it's much better. Certainly, the camera is fantastic. The video is great. I haven't had any problems with it yet. So what are we now? March, the end of March. What's that, 4 months? And it's great. So if you're in Europe, or if you're somewhere that has them, I know they will come to America because they're doing, you know, well. Because they've had a few of them now. As I say, this is the Fairphone 3, and each one gets better. You should be able to get them in America eventually. But the other great thing that I haven't even talked about is that they're really big on the community and the source of their raw materials and parts that go to make up the phone. So they've gone right down the supply chain, right down to having relationships with the people who work in the mines, and they will only work with mines where the health and safety of the workers is respected, the workers are paid a reasonable wage, where the ecological impact of the mine is as neutral as it can be. So they're very much into people and the planet, and it's a beautiful thing. And the phone is not that expensive. It's €450 for the phone, outright, no plans. And yeah, I can't really recommend it highly enough. Even if you can't get one, if you're, you know, in America, go to their Instagram or just keep up with the story, so that when they do become available, you can get one. Because I think it's a good thing, and we should try and, I think the more support they enterprises like that get, the better, because you've got your vote, your political vote, but then your real vote is your what you spend your money on. So, yeah, I think it's a beautiful thing, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. Fairphone. I'll put a link in the show notes, but it's easy enough to find. F-A-I-R phone. Fairphone. Okay, so that's it for this one. Shortish one. Oh, not that short. Yeah, do go to the old Salvador Dali thing. Put your votes in. All going well. There should be another podcast out really quickly, and you'll get to hear how I really speak without all the editing. I'll tell you now. I know my vocal tics really well. I say before everything. There you go. You see. And what else? I say, you know, a lot, way more than I need to. And what's the other one I do? Like. Yeah. So I've got, they're the main three. Like, you know, and And if I'm particularly in the middle of a flow, I'll say, you know, a million times. So I'm just warning you. But still, it'll be content. It'll be a podcast. And it'll be something that I'm hoping makes the social distancing a little bit less isolating. Okay, so speak to you soon, I hope, and I hope you're well and of good cheer. Until we talk again, bye for now.